Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. This morning, we have a number of bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. We also have a couple of bills that were scheduled for work session. I want to make an announcement for those who might be here for a work session on Senate Bill 370. We do not have the paperwork, so we will not be able to work 370 today. So if you're here today and waiting for that, you're not going to see that move forward. And do we need to just roll that one over, or are we going to just reschedule?
Reschedule.
So we'll reschedule 370 once we have the paperwork, so sometime in the future. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and go a little bit out of the order on the agenda today and drop down to Senate Bill 379. Chana, who is one of our legal counsels, this is her only bill, so I want to give her the opportunity to get her work done here and outside of the hearing. So we'll open up the public hearing on 379.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 379 is the product of the Oregon Law Commission. This is the 2015 update to the probate code. This has been worked for a number of years by the Law Commission Standing Work Group. The Dash 3 amendments embody the substance of the recommendations. There are 34 sections to the amendment. I'd like to start one by one and go through them. Just kidding. What I will direct you at is the work group report that is on OLIS, which details each and every section, what it does, and how they get there. There are several changes that are very minor and small that have a long-term effect, and there are changes that are rather large. Some of the larger changes allow establishment by clear and convincing evidence a will that hasn't met all of the formal requirements of a will, such as two witness signatures. There's also an avenue for inheritance for a child conceived after the death of one of the parents using genetic material. So there are many, many changes here, and we have Lane Shetterly to tell us a little bit about it.
Lane, why don't you come on up? You're the only one that appears to be scheduled for 379. While Lane's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 379? Good morning, Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I thought for sure someone else would want to get up here and talk about the rule in Shelley's case, but yes. I guess it's just me. For the record, Lane Shetterly, I'm here as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and actually also chair of the Probate Modernization Work Group that brings you Senate Bill 379 with the Dash 3 amendments, which, as Chana said, comprise the bill that we have before you today. I'll be very brief. For one thing, there's nobody else to testify. I'm happy to answer questions for you. I do want to refer, as Shauna did, on to the report, which does constitute the legislative record of this. Oregon Law Commission bills typically are accompanied by reports from the work group, and the Oregon courts have recognized the work group reports as authoritative legislative history, and so it's important that we acknowledge the report as accompanying the bill. As Shauna said, this is the product of the Probate Modernization Work Group. It's actually phase one of the work group. We will be coming back to you probably in a year, maybe 2 years, actually dealing with the probate process. That's the next thing. But the first bite was dealing with the preliminaries to probate, and that is primarily intestacy and wills in Chapter 112 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. As Shauna said, we made a number of changes, many of them minor and technical. A few of them more substantive, and I will just briefly touch on them. Shauna already mentioned them to you, but I will just for the record. One of the changes that we did make that is of a more substantive nature and really in the theme of modernization. This is the chapter ORS 112.305 currently provides that a testator's marriage revokes a previously executed will unless the testator meets certain conditions in making out the will. So that if you're unmarried when you make a will and then you get married, under most circumstances that later marriage will revoke your prior will on the presumption that you probably would have intended to make a new will if you'd thought about it. Well, now that we have had unmarried couples living under domestic partnerships who have gone ahead and gotten married, technically a spouse, partners under a domestic partnership, who may have made wills for each other while in that partnership, if they have gone ahead and gotten married, now that we have marriage equality, then the new will would revoke the will that they made while they were in their domestic partnership. That's an anomalous outcome. We've changed the statute to clarify that a new will under that circumstance does not revoke a will that was made while the partners were in a domestic partnership. Another new statute, again, under, in the theme of modernization, which is the title of the work group, deals with the children who are conceived after the death of the testator, something that when the probate code was written before was not even contemplated. So we have a situation where, of course, genetic material can be saved for a long time. And what do we do with those children who are ultimately born of that genetic material of a decedent? We want to recognize the ability of someone to preserve their genetic material and even designate children born of that genetic material. The technical term in the work group, by the way, was stuff. To recognize them as heirs, but it presents some problems if you don't put some sidebars around that. For one thing, when a decedent passes away, you do want to be able to administer the estate at some point in time and not have to worry about 10 years later or 15 years later a child being born from the genetic material and wanting his or her share of the estate. There's also the question of intent. It's not automatic that somebody who preserves their genetic material necessarily intends that a child born of that genetic material would be an heir. And so the way we have dealt with it, we recognize the technology. What we've said in this bill is that a child born conceived after the death of a decedent will be recognized as an heir, a child of that parent, if there is a mention of posthumously conceived children in a will or a trust. So we want to make sure that there was an intent there that this genetic material that becomes a child later be actually considered an heir of the decedent. And so we want the mention of a will and also a statement saying that the genetic material can be used posthumously. That's another condition that we want to make sure that they understood. And we've also said that the child conceived posthumously must be in utero within 2 years after the decedent's death. So that way we cut off at some point in time. You don't have this possibility of somebody coming in that many years later.
Senator Cruz, why don't you go?
If I could, Mr. Chair, I can understand, okay, I'm married. I've reserved some genetic material. At some point, my widow decides to have a child. I can understand that, but this wouldn't be expanded to, I put genetic material into a sperm bank, and it does include that. So somebody that may be clear outside of the relationship would have a call on the estate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, if you have, and this is why we put the sidebars on there, if you have specifically provided for posthumously conceived children in a will or a trust, if you have signed a statement saying that you want that genetic that you agree that the genetic material can be used posthumously, and if the child is conceived within 2 years of your death.
So it would be under my direction.
It would be under your direction. That's right. That's right. And that's very important. It is. Yes, that's right. And some, you know, some states that are looking at this, we were not comfortable with lack of sidebars on that. So that's why we built these.
Let's follow up on this.
I just have one more section I was going to talk about, but I thought this one might be a little bit of interest to the committee.
I want to go back to,
okay,
but we'll come back to that. Senator Gelser.
So how would that impact embryos that are in storage? So those would have been conceived prior to the death, but not implanted. Are those considered conceived not posthumously or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, they have to be in utero within 2 years after the date of death.
But if the trigger is that they have to be, that I have the hardest time saying that word.
Posthumously.
If they're conceived after your death.
Yes. But
has it been conceived prior to the death if the embryos were created and stored before the person dies?
Mr. Chair, Senator...
Conception when the embryo is created or when it is implanted in the uterus?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, you know, that's a good question. I think in this case, again, since all of the conditions have to be met, one of those conditions is that it must be in utero within 2 years after death. So I'm not sure that the first issue there is necessarily determinative. We do have to have that because, again, the same issue. You wouldn't want that happening. Frankly, we can't have that happening 5 years, 10 years after a person has passed away and their estate has been administered. And also, I should say, there's one other thing that there's one other condition here that the party in control of the genetic material has to notify the personal representative of the estate within 4 months, so that they know that there's something coming. That they know that they have this other material out there that may become a child, and if those conditions are met, it really doesn't matter whether it's an embryo or just the disassociated material. Those conditions still have to be met.
All right. Okay. Senator, did you have a question?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. To follow up on Senator Gelser's question, there's a big difference between genetic material and an embryo because an embryo involves two parties. In other words, an embryo has to be a fertilized egg. And so you've got the person who passed away, and then you also have someone who presumably is alive who's responsible
Good
for
point.
The embryo.
Good
so
point.
I think that's what Senator Gelser was trying to get at, is how would this provision treat embryos?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, is there a biologist in the room? In that case, I think it's important that, and that's a good point, the other parent still has control of that, and that embryo can be the heir of that other parent for any length of period, as long as that parent has control and of that embryo. We're talking here about just the effect of that embryo on the deceased person's estate or intestate rights of heirs.
Because to follow up, Mr. Chair, because you could have a situation where the let's say the man dies and the woman is still alive, and the woman wants to save the embryo for 5 years, and so how would this estate provision require 2 years? I think that's.
And just tagging on to that, generally there are multiple embryos that are stored, so she may choose to immediately have one of the embryos and then have the sibling embryo later.
Let me see if I can help out a little bit here. It sounds to me what the commission has come up with is the 2-year cutoff for the estate of the deceased. So I think the rule would be whatever has happened, unless that estate has not closed, that portion would be, let's say, resolved or taken care of, and then only whatever would be in the estate of the surviving or the living parent would still be in play. I mean, at some point you have to be able to shut this down as to being able to close the estates, and that was my follow-up, which is I was going to ask was, it sounds to me that if an estate has actually been closed, it's not going to be reopened if unless there's fraud or deceit or something like that occurred, and even then it's going to be pretty hard to do anything in the sense of the estate. You'd have to go after the person for something. But
yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chair, because again the technology here does create potential for problems where you have the possibility of these children being born so many years after and even after an estate has been distributed. And that is why, in this case, at least with respect to the decedent, we've put that 2-year time frame in those other conditions. If you have an embryo, you know, that is still, you know, associated with a living parent, why, you know, these issues are not relevant to that living parent, only to that partner, that contributor, that parent who has passed away.
So, all right, any other questions on that?
Very 21st century.
All right, so let me, okay, so just for clarification, we have that 2-year rule, and notice has to be within 4 months. If you have an estate that's still open, and the personal representative gets word of this individual that has some right or claim in that estate, what's going to happen to the estate itself? Are they going to just set aside some amount and then be able to close the estate, or is the estate going to go into perpetuity?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. So you, I can see a couple of scenarios, and it may depend on the circumstances. You may elect to keep the estate open because the fact that someone gives notice doesn't necessarily mean that they're actually going to follow through. And if they do, it doesn't necessarily mean that the child will be born living. Things can happen. Untoward things can happen. And so it would be prudent, I think, in some cases to just keep the estate open for that period to see what develops over time before you close it. If a personal representative does that, certainly if I was advising them, I would look at the nature of the estate, and you do hate to keep heirs waiting too long for their shares. Often what we do if we have assets that appear to be sufficient to bear the risk, we'll ask the court for permission to make preliminary partial distributions so that you can at least get some money out to the heirs, holding back enough for a full share and, you know, a reserve for any costs and expenses. And then if that child is born within that two-year period, you'd have enough there left over for that child's share. If that child's not born for any reason within that two-year period, then you would just make a further distribution. The estate technically would be open, but you don't have to make everybody wait that full two-year period.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification on that. And then I think the other part of that to tie this down would be if the child was born, then to close the estate, they would make a trust, I'm assuming, a distribution for the child that's just been born so they could close out the estate and not go into perpetuity.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that would be correct. Again, one of the requirements is that the will or trust make provision for a posthumously conceived and born child. So I would assume if you're making provision for that, you would also make provision for a trust, a conservatorship, custodianship, that kind of thing for that afterborn child's share.
You said you have one more
set. Yeah, I do. Just
I
one.
Go back to another one, but one. Oh,
okay, the last one is what we call the doctrine of harmless error, which is new to Oregon. We have fairly traditional requirements for the execution of wills, that a will be signed in the presence of two witnesses, that the two witnesses have to sign the will stating that they witnessed the execution. Has to be within relatively contemporaneous time frame. And, you know, we don't, for instance, as some states do, recognize what's called a holographic will. Some states just recognize that if you write a will in your own handwriting and you sign it and no other witnesses, then we're going to consider that to be a valid will. Or the committee wasn't comfortable in going that far in recognizing new forms of execution of a will. But the fact is that some people, not working with lawyers, do make mistakes in how they execute their wills. They might sign it with one witness, or they might have a notary notarize it, but not with any witnesses, and think that that's how you do a will. Fully intending that that be their will, but having failed to meet some technical requirement of execution. What we've adopted in this statute now is a doctrine, it's called harmless error, where if you can show by clear and convincing evidence, if the proponent of a will can show by clear and convincing evidence that this document signed by the testator was intended by the testator to be their last will and testament, and that any error in the execution of the will was harmless. That is, it doesn't affect the intent and the validity of the document itself. If you can show that to a court by clear and convincing evidence, then that document can be recognized as that person's will. That's new under Oregon law. We think it's a fair nod to situations where intent was absolutely clear, no question as to what the testator wanted, but because of some technical formality, when they pass away, the will is is not recognized as valid, and so their estate falls under the laws of intestate succession. By the same token, we didn't want to open the door to just anything getting in as a will. One of the protections, or one of the reasons we have requirements, formalities for executions of wills, is to avoid, to protect against fraud and undue influence and those kinds of things. And we didn't want to make this harmless error rule so broad as to just open the door to those problematic scenarios. So we do require a specific petition and a hearing in order to establish the validity of that will with notice to heirs, so that people who are concerned about this and may be affected can protect their interests or the interests of the decedent if it looks like there was some misconduct going on by somebody. And the court does have to find by clear and convincing evidence that the decedent intended the document to be his or her will. So that is a middle ground that we thought provides some additional flexibility for people who may be unrepresented and may just have missed a technical requirement in the execution of a will, but should not, because of that, have their will found to be invalidated and have their estate passed under intestacy and not given any effect to that will. So we think we've done a good job of kind of threading the needle there of protecting testator's intent without throwing open the doors to documents that would be could subject people to fraud and financial and other abuse. Mr. Chair, you had a question.
I did have a question. I want to go back to the same-sex marriage.
Yes.
The clarification I need is that if they had already had a will under their domestic partnership and then they entered into a new will after that date, and after they were married, wouldn't the first will automatically be extinguished based on the new one? Because I maybe misunderstood what you said, but it's
yeah.
to me.
Mr. Chair, in that case, if they make a new will, yes, it would revoke the prior will. That's one of the means of revoking a will. The situation we're getting at is where they don't make, where they don't make a new will. They made the will while they were in their domestic partnership, then they got married, and for their purposes, nothing's changed. They didn't make a new will. Right now, technically under our law, that subsequent marriage between the same partners would still invalidate their prior will because it's marriage and it revokes a will that was made prior to marriage. We wanted to make sure that was a serious. This is where they make the will during they've made the will while they were domestic partners. Then they got married and never thought to make a new will. They won't die intestate because of that. That will made during the domestic partnership will continue to have effect and will not be revoked by their subsequent marriage. If they make a new will, then they've revoked it by their own act, and there's no problem with that.
So just the other, for clarification, if it's not a same-sex marriage, it's a marriage between a man and a woman, they had made some type of wills prior to, and then they get married, is it, I just didn't understand the law to say upon marriage, it extinguishes that other will.
Mr. Chair, it does. And part of that is that we don't, you know, there's no way to legally establish what that relationship was prior to marriage. Domestic partnership, of course, we have that. But that is the current law, and it's not changed under this bill.
Right. So the catch here, just to make certain we have this for on the record, is that there had to be a domestic partnership relationship that was recognized under that parameter for this to apply. If it wasn't a domestic partnership relationship, but they were living together, made separate wills, whatever it was, those would be extinguished based on the time of marriage.
That is correct. And I just, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify also just for the committee's understanding on this point. The revocation, where you have that situation of a couple living together before they get married, and then they get married. Under the statute, it does say that if the will expresses an intent that it not be revoked. So, for instance, and I've done this before, made will for people who are living together intending to get married. You can simply say that if we get married, our marriage will not revoke the will.
Right.
And it says also it was drafted under other circumstances establishing that it was in contemplation of the marriage. So there's some way to look at that, but it still requires an examination of the circumstances. circumstances under which the will was made. Except in the domestic partner case there, we've categorically said if it was made in the context of a domestic partnership and then they get married, that will is safe.
I could see in a relationship where they were planning, let's say, and they were going to do some extravagant type of travel.
Right.
And they entered the wills prior to getting married and then they're taking off, that would be a way that they could have everything taken care of prior to maybe some unfortunate demise.
That's right.
Okay, so if I could, okay. I have a will.
Good.
Okay. Everything.
That's great. One out of ten.
Fortunately, everything goes to my kids, so you don't get it.
We have an adoption bill coming up.
Yeah.
So if I'm foolish enough to get married again, and who knows, I might, at that point, at the point I get married, any will I have previous to that is revoked. Correct?
No. Mr. Chair, you've made, let's see.
I mean, chances are I'm going to make a new will anyway, because my new wife would probably prefer that. But.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yes. Okay. You're saying if
I get married.
If you get married, yes. And that is chapter 112.305. It's not changed. The will is revoked by the subsequent marriage of the testator if the testator is survived by a spouse. Now, interestingly, if you get remarried and your spouse passes away, then basically your prior will is revived. But if you are survived by a spouse, again, the contemplation, the law presumes that when you get married, you would have intended to make some provision for that spouse.
Okay.
If you enter into a premarital agreement, then this does not apply because you would state expressly that it not be revoked.
Okay.
So there are ways around that. But if you don't do anything, then the law presumes that you would have intended to do something. And under the laws of intestate succession, in that case, half of your estate would pass to that surviving spouse, half would pass to your children.
Okay. If you have any kind of estate at all, dying intestate is really a bad move.
It's not a good idea.
Senator Thatcher.
Yeah, I have a question about personal assets or just the definition of assets. Does that include digital assets?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, hold that thought for next Tuesday. The short answer is yes, it does. It does. There are, and we'll have a hearing on digital assets in a different, in a related context on Tuesday. So it does include digital assets. The challenge with digital assets really is in identifying them and gaining access to them. That's the real issue. They are part of the estate.
Wait, that's next week.
That's next Tuesday.
Right. I understand, but I just want to make sure it's defined.
They do.
See Google and everyone coming to the Google.
They're probably on the airplanes right now, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, thank you for all the explanations.
Thank you.
My two carriers on this will need all this information so they can take care of this on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I commend the report to them. It has lots of good information.
All right.
Thank you.
That's not
right. Thank you.
Today.
And not today?
Not today.
Okay. Don't worry. Not yet. All right. We're going to go ahead.
Senator Thatcher, he keeps looking at both of us.
What?
I know he's got to carry the bill. I just had to have something before. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 37. No.
That's a good explanation. Pretty sad.
Yeah, sorry. I lost my place here. 379. So let's see. All right, what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 604, looking at the witness list as to who we have here, as to trying to just move people through. And at this point, Laura, if you'll go ahead and give us the overview.
Of course. Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 604 is sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary. We don't have the paperwork back for it today, but it is in the works. And we do have a -5 amendment before us today. And to clarify, that -5 amendment actually combines changes made in the -1, -2, and -3 amendments. And it clarifies terms and specifies direct agencies. So in 2014, federal legislation requires all states to enact the 2008 Uniform Interstate Family Support Act amendments as a condition of continuing to receive federal funds for state child support programs. Failure to enact the amendments during this legislative session could result in the loss of important federal funding. Senate Bill 604 incorporates the 2008 Uniform Interstate Family Support Act amendments into Oregon law.
Okay, Lane, I have you back up, and Kate, you're here today. Thank you. And then Michael Ritchie. This is almost like homecoming. you two do need to sit next to each other.
Yeah. Actually, it's probably better for us kept apart.
All right, so who's going to lead off?
Mr. Chair, I will take 30 seconds, again, for the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm here now. I've changed hats. I went back and I put on the my Uniform Law Commission hat. This bill comes to you courtesy of the Uniform Law Commission. It's an amendment from 2008 to UIFSA, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. You thought I didn't know the title of the act, yeah. To incorporate new provisions adopted by the Hague Convention. It has been waiting for all these years for Congress to approve the convention and then authorize or direct states to adopt UIFSA. Very briefly, just because I know these things are interesting to you, the Uniform Law Commission is very much a federalist organization. It is an organization of the states that promotes uniformity of law among the states by concerted action of state legislatures. Generally, the Uniform Law Commission, that is where uniformity is desirable among the states. The Uniform Law Commission really sees uniformity among the states being achieved better that way, where it's appropriate, than by direct congressional action, federal action. So sometimes there's some tension between the Uniform Law Commission and Congress, where the Uniform Law Commission thinks it has a better way to address uniformity among states than through federal legislation. This is one of those happy cases of what we call cooperative federalism, where the United States enters a convention. Congress adopts federal legislation that approves the convention, and then what they do is they say, states, you adopt what the Uniform Law Commission has adopted as a uniform act, and if you do that, then we'll consider you compliant with federal law, and by complying with federal law, the United States then is in compliance with the convention. So it's a very happy coming together of the states and Congress here in this concept of cooperative federalism. So Kate is going to give you the details on the bill. I will just say I remember when UIFSA was last up, when I was in the legislature, the word that I got, Mr. Chair, from up there was, you got to pass this because there's federal money for child support attached to it. In the simplest terms, that's sort of the same message this time around as well. And I would say, too, you will look, if you look at the bill, there are style issues and there's even language issues, things that may look different than most Oregon statutes. Many times when legislative council gets a Uniform Law Commission bill, they will style it according to Oregon style, legislative style, which is fine. Doesn't affect uniformity, but it makes it look more like one of ours. In this case, because it is tied to the Hague Convention and federal law, states are really encouraged, directed as much as they can be, not to change the text, that actual uniformity is important here. And so there are drafting issues and have been that have come up as this has been looked at. We've consulted with the Uniform Law Commission staff in Chicago. They've consulted in turn with Congress. And for the most part, the word has been, no, leave the words the same, because we do want this so that back at the internationally, countries looking at this are satisfied that what we have here in Oregon complies with the Hague Convention. And they don't want to have to be interpreting Oregon words against the actual text of the act.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Kate Cooper Richardson, the director of the Oregon Child Support Program and division administrator for the Division of Child Support at the Department of Justice. Lane's 5 minutes or his 30 seconds was as long as his 5 minutes.
Well, we knew that before. Going into it. He's sitting next to each other.
Actually, I too was around working with Lane back when this came through back in the 97 session. So little did I know that I'd be sitting before you years later saying, what was the line? Congress says you have to pass this or we're going to lose all our child support funds. That's kind of the long and short of it. But my testimony before you, the written testimony has, and the also the supporting documents from the Uniform Law Commission, kind of gives you the background on what this bill does. We are repealing the earlier version, or one of the, Oregon had not the most recent version of UIFSA, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, but the original version before, we are repealing that and then replacing it with the USA amendments of 2008, because it did take Congress a long, long time to act, of 2008, which incorporates some of the changes that were made in 2001. Some states did adopt the USA of 2001, so we actually don't even have uniformity within the United States right now on our child support interstate laws. We don't have a lot of cases here in Oregon that are international cases. It's under 200, we do have many countries that are a part of the convention. So we will see some benefit here. It's not just that we're passing this because we're being told to and we need the money. It will have some benefits of uniformity and some efficiencies when dealing with support orders abroad. We could, and Mike Ritchie is counsel for the program and is here as my technical backup in case you come up with questions I can't answer, which could be very likely, so I will ask for some. But if you want any details here, I'm happy to go through it. Otherwise, I think it's pretty much before you in the written testimony.
Questions?
Well, that's how I like it.
Comments? All right, so basically what we're hearing is the purse strings have been somewhat tied to this as how the federal funds would be, let's say, continue to flow into the state or not.
Indeed. And you may or may not know, but the Child Support Program is a federal program, Title 4D of the Social Security Act, and the Department of Justice administers it in Oregon, and it's a two-for-one match. It's a very good value that we get, and we do great work. I'm very proud of our program, and I believe in all the premises that are underlying the Family Support Act anyway, but it does, the money is very persuasive. And frankly, all the states must pass it in this legislative session for the U.S. to ratify the treaty. And although the U.S. was one of the first signatories, we're one of the last to actually ratify the treaty.
Okay. Any questions or comments? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm so proud of her.
We'll talk
Boy,
later.
I'm going to go there.
I'd get out of the real quick. I'll give you that much time. Kate, hang on there for a second. All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 604? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll close the public hearing on 604. And that's going to move us from... there, going back to the top, to Senate Bill 378. Laura?
Sure. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 378 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for Senator Devlin. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. We did have a prior public hearing on it February 11th. So current Oregon law defines the term boarding kennel as a facility that provides care for a feed to dogs that stay at the facility an average of less than 30 days. This language is used in multiple ORS sections, specifically sections addressing dog breeders. The statutes governing dog control laws, however, do not define boarding kennel. So Senate Bill 378, then, defines boarding kennel using the same language found in other ORS sections and specifically excludes dog breeders from the definition. It clarifies the definition of keeper and specifically excludes boarding kennels. And it clarifies license fee applications and specifically excludes dogs considered inventory.
All right. I have two individuals that have signed up, Linda Siegert, I believe, and Robert McFerrin. Why don't you two please come forward? While they're coming up, is there anyone else who would want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 378? Thank you both for being here, and thank you for being patient as we got through the other bills. Who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Thank you all. I appreciate this opportunity. I will be brief. My name is Linda Siegert, and I'm here this morning to request this committee approve Senate Bill 378 in order to remove the ambiguity from Oregon's public nuisance laws as it relates to dog breeders. On November 9th, 2012, Crook County Circuit Court Judge Gary L. Williams determined that dog breeders are exempt from public nuisance law because they are a licensed business primarily intended to obtain a profit from the kenneling of dogs. He determined that the verbs kenneling and breeding mean the same thing. On the surface, this issue might seem trivial or unimportant to this committee. However, I can assure you that Judge Williams' interpretation of the current nuisance statutes has had a profoundly negative effect on the lives of many good, decent people who only wish to be granted the same opportunity as everyone else to enjoy the peace and quiet of their homes. Please do not interpret this request as a crusade against dog breeders. On the contrary, my only wish is to remove the current ambiguity so that all citizens, whether homeowners or dog breeders, are treated fairly and equally under Oregon laws. By enacting public nuisance laws, I believe the legislature's intent is for everyone to be responsible for their own animals, regardless of whether they're used for profit or simply enjoyed as companions. Senate Bill 378 will help to ensure that that intent is realized. I thank you for the opportunity to speak before this committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, let's go ahead and get Robert's testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Your Honor, and all you, Your Honors. I am a neighbor of a dog
Robert,
breed.
Robert, before your testimony, I do need to have you state your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Robert McFerrin. I live in Crook County.
Great.
I don't know that I represent, but I am a member of a neighborhood that is affected by a specific dog breeder who has 40 to 50 dogs. I would just like to go on record as saying that there's no way that people can enjoy their own property when they are in direct proximity to dog breeders that make no attempt to abate the noise from their dogs at all. We can't open our windows at night. if we do, we'll be woke up 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 times during the night by dogs. And I brought a recording of what they sound like, if you'd like to hear what 50 yapping dogs sound like in the middle of the night.
If I'm looking at this, I'd say, no, thank you.
I don't blame you. Nobody should have to hear that. And that's all. Unless any of you have any questions.
Yeah. Let's see if there are any questions. First, I'm going to go with Senator Thatcher and then back to Senator Burdick.
Sure. I was just wondering, is this a neighborhood?
Like yes, it's a residential neighborhood. It's RR5M, which is rural residential 5 mobile homes allowed.
Can you follow up?
5-acre lots?
Minimum of 2-acre lots.
Okay, thank you.
Although most are larger than that, but 2 to 5 acres.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Senator Burdick?
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, the reason for this bill is because if these were like neighbors who had a whole bunch of dogs, you'd have a nuisance complaint that you could pursue, but because of the way the judge interpreted the statute, you don't have any recourse because they are a business. Is that correct?
That is correct. Most people in our neighborhood have dogs. They're all expected to control their dogs to keep them from barking in a nuisance factor. We used to be able to call in a complaint and have the sheriff's department come out and serve the kennel for undue noise prolonged for an excess of 30 minutes during the night. Because Judge Williams chose to reinterpret the law to exclude that, we can't even do that anymore. We have absolutely no recourse for, and there's therefore no attempt made to control dog noise at all from this kennel.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I do want to get a little clarification. Judge Williams, I believe, was in Washington County?
Crook
County.
Okay, I understand that then. All right, so Senator Thatcher.
Well, I guess, so are there practical ways that you know of? I would hate to be in the situation, but I'm just looking at the dog breeder, too. Would they be shut down in this case? Or are there ways that they can put up sound walls? I don't know.
If they put up sound walls, if the dogs were, right now they're just out in the open in chain link kennels. And if there were in buildings with sound abatement, we probably wouldn't notice them ever. But there's absolutely no attempt to control sound at all.
And this property, this area has always been zoned residential, you know, since anybody has, you know, any of the, either the dog breeder or any of the residents have moved in. It was always residential and always subject to public nuisance laws. So.
Okay. And basically the county and enforcement, they would have multiple ways of trying to get compliance. Clearly, if they were not able to get compliance after numerous attempts through their structure, then you could actually have them be noticed to shut down. They still would have to go through a public hearing and all like that for that to occur. But normally there'd be some type of fines that would be there, or they would maybe potentially instruct them that they would have to have some type of noise abatement process. Any other questions? All right, thank you all very much for coming over from Crook County. And also, Linda, you're out of Washington County?
I'm out of Washington County,
okay.
Yes.
Thank
I,
you very
I used
much
to be
for
in Crook
on.
County.
All right. So is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 378? Not seeing anyone. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Is that all right?
Oh, I was just going to say, apparently Linda moved so she could get some sleep.
Yeah.
There is a lot of truth in that.
Okay.
Thank you.
We do have, I think, all the paperwork for 378. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 378.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 378 to the floor with a due process recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I'm looking at the bill, and it doesn't look like this had a individual senator. So is there anyone?
It did.
Is there anyone who wants to carry the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would, having suffered through multiple barking dogs when I lived in Washington, D.C., I would be delighted to carry this
All right.
bill.
Senator Burdick will be the carrier of the bill. Thank you very much. We will close the work session once again. And I think that takes care of all. Oh, wait, we got a work session down on 371. So with that, we'll open up our work session on Senate Bill 371.
The Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 371 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar's workers' compensation section. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. We had a public hearing on the bill February 17th. And so currently in Oregon, insurers and self-insured employers are not required to provide deceased workers' estate or their beneficiaries copies of the notice of closure of a workers' compensation case. This obviously presents challenges for those to know if there is a claim that exists that they need to address and to do it in a timely manner. Additionally, Oregon law requires the insurer and self-insured employer to pay certain costs for depositions arranged by an injured worker in reconsideration proceedings. The statute is currently silent on the matter of interpreter services, and there have been problems with those costs being denied. Senate Bill 371 seeks to address both these issues.
All right. So we have no amendments at all.
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 371 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 371 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll be honest with you. I guess I'm not sure is this a real specific problem, or is this a widespread problem? I'm not really getting my arms around what the problem is.
So this originally, it dates back to a 2010 case, Safe v. Wild, and it has been a problem. I think the rates are not high of this happening, but when this does happen, the consequences are pretty grave for the parties that would otherwise receive notice of a notice of closure and being able to then react to that in a timely manner. So this bill does both requires that notice to be mailed in and extends the length of time that those parties would have to respond. And then absolutely there's been a couple cases of the cost of interpreters being denied by insurance companies. The statute isn't exactly clear on that point currently.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right. Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. Approved. And let's see, Senator Gelser, are you okay with this one?
Mm-hmm.
So Senator Gelser would be the carrier on Senate Bill 371. So we'll close the work session on that. We had one other one that was set for public hearing and possible work session. That's Senate Bill 593. The sign-up sheet has no one on there, but let me see. I'm going to go ahead and see if anyone's here for Senate Bill 593. Everyone's looking around. Mm-hmm. No one's coming up here.
It's
no one wants it.
A full room
coming,
too, isn't
coming,
it?
Going, going, gone. So, with that, we'll go ahead and complete our work for today. We'll be back tomorrow at 8:30. And I want to give everyone notice next week because of our workload, we're going to start at 8:00. Sorry, Senator Roberta. 8:00 because we just have some stuff that needs to happen. And I would presume not this next Friday, but the first Friday in April will be a meeting time for us as well. We will go into needing to use our Fridays to make certain we have all of our work done on the Senate bills. And so we'll be on the call of the chair, but it looks like the very first Friday of April, you should consider yourself needed to be here.
And Senator Brzezinski, I have my brother is getting married that day in Nevada. I will not be here on that first Friday in April.
Invited?
I don't know if you'd want it. Well, I know you're looking to get married, but
I just made a comment, okay?
So I cannot be here that day. The wedding is actually on that Friday.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I'm working on my excuse as well.
I appreciate that. All right, with that, we're adjourned.